I think we'll turn for just a moment. It's described in different places, but I think we'll turn to Isaiah for just a moment. The 37th chapter. Well, in the 36th, this king came, or rather he sent. He begins his threats, well, the beginning of 36. In the 14th year of King Hezekiah, that Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the defense cities of Judah and took them. Things looked pretty hopeless. King of Assyria sent Rabshakeh from Lachish to Jerusalem unto King Hezekiah with a great army, and he stood by the conduit of the upper pool in the highway of the Fuller's Field, and he began to threaten. The fourth verse, what confidence is this wherein thou trustest? I say, sayest thou, but they're vain words. I have counsel and strength for war. Now on whom dost thou trust that thou rebellest against me? Thou trustest in the staff of this broken reed on Egypt, whereon if a man lean, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all that trust in him. That may have been the truth. I don't know. But don't say we trust in God. Is it not he whose high places Hezekiah has taken away? And he went on with this, and they asked him not to speak in the Jews' language in the 11th verse, because said, speaking the Syrian language, we understand it. No, he said, he wanted to speak to them in their language and let them know what was going to come upon them. He told them to make an agreement with him by a present. I was impressed with that. People want that money, don't they? Come out to me and eat ye every one of his own vine, and come until I come and take you away to a land like your own. I'm going to take you to other countries. 18th verse, he warned them against Hezekiah. Hezekiah said, answer them not, in the 21st verse. Then they came in the 21st verse, Eliakim and Hilkiah, came to Shebna the scribe, Joah the son of Asaph the recorder. They came to Hezekiah with their clothes rent, told him the words of Rabshakeh, and he sent them to Isaiah, the second verse of the next chapter. And they came to Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amos, and he already had his message from God. They told him it's a day of rebuke. And you pray it may be, they said in the fourth verse, the Lord may hear the words of this man. And he already had the message from God. Go back and say, thus shall you say unto your master, be not afraid of the words that thou hast heard, wherewith the servants of the king of Assyria have blasphemed me. I will send a blast upon him, and he shall hear a rumor and return to his own land, and I will cause him to fall by the sword in his own land. And they continued to be blasphemous toward God. Then Isaiah repeated his message only more strongly in the 21st verse of this 37th chapter. Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, whereas thou hast prayed to me against Sennacherib, king of Assyria, this is the word. The virgin, the daughter of Zion, hath despised thee and laughed thee to scorn. The daughter of Jerusalem hath shaken her head at thee. Whom hast thou reproached and blasphemed? And against whom hast thou exalted thy voice? Lifted up thine eyes on high, even against the Holy One of Israel. Then he goes on to say, I brought it to pass, he tells him, that you'd do certain things. And then you know what happened. The Lord sent forth one angel in the 36th verse of this 37th chapter. When they arose in the morning, behold, they were all dead carp. What a statement. And he fled to his own country, and his sons killed him. And in the Chronicles or Kings, I've forgotten which it is, it said that he returned to his country ashamed of face, and then his two sons killed him. But in the 10th chapter of the book of Isaiah, Isaiah had prophesied about this, and he said in about the 12th verse, Wherefore it shall come to pass that when the Lord hath performed his whole work upon Mount Zion, I will punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria. I'm reading the 12th verse. And the glory of his high looks. For he saith, by the strength of my hand I have done it, and by my wisdom, for I am prudent. And I have removed the bounds of the people and have robbed their treasures. I have put down the inhabitants like a valiant man. He was a great man in his own estimation. My hand hath found as a nest the riches of the people, and as one gathereth eggs that are left, have I gathered all the earth. Then the Lord asks him this question, shall the axe boast itself against him that heweth therewith? Shall the saw magnify itself against him that shaketh it? As if the rod should shake itself against them that lift it up, or as if the staff should lift up itself against, as if it were no wood. Therefore shall the Lord of hosts, send among his fat ones leanness. That's this Assyrian king. Under his glory he shall kindle a burning like the burning of a fire, and the light of Israel shall be a fire, and his holy one for a flame, and it shall burn and devour his thorns and his briars. and we don't need to read it, but it goes right on for a number of verses. And this is the first that Nahum was seeing that was going to come to pass. And this 15th verse, notice just how it reads now. Behold upon the mountains the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, that publisheth peace, O Judah. Keep thy solemn feasts, perform thy vows, for the wicked shall no more pass through thee. He is utterly cut off. Now this, in the prophet's mind, was those bringing the message that this wicked king and his armies had been cut off. Isaiah puts it in a little different light in Isaiah 52:7, and this is the one that Paul quotes in Romans 10, which we will look at in just a moment. Isaiah 52:7 reads like this: How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, that publisheth peace, that bringeth good tidings of good, that publisheth salvation, that saith unto Zion, Thy God liveth, thy watchmen shall lift up the voice, with the voice together shall they sing. Now this is what Paul quoted in Romans 10:15 when he said this: How shall they preach except they be sent? As it is written, How beautiful are the feet of them that preach the gospel of peace, and bring glad tidings of good things. Now Nahum told them, Keep your vows. In other words, observe your feast. The fellow that sought your life is dead. But Isaiah seemed to have the gospel in view under the Spirit of God. And on into the second chapter. Now, when Nineveh was overthrown, it was the Babylonians in league with others that overthrew them. And this took place some time after this affair, but that is the overthrow of Nineveh. But the overthrow of Assyria took place, I mean not Assyria, but this king of Assyria, took place in the time of Isaiah, and possibly of this man, we believe it was, at this time. Wonder if they had a dinner together to celebrate it. Now here's what came against Nineveh of old. This is their destruction. He that dasheth in pieces is come up before thy face. Notice he that dasheth in pieces. Notice now what Babylon is called in Ezekiel 50:23. My, the Lord can come up with the right kind of titles for things and people. How is the hammer of the whole earth cut asunder and broken? How has Babylon become a desolation among the nations? Notice here he calls them the hammer of the whole earth. And in this text that we just read, it's he that dasheth in pieces is come up before thy face. And he said, Keep the munition, watch the way, make thy loins strong, and fortify thy power mightily. For the Lord hath turned away the excellency of Jacob, as the excellency of Israel, for the emptiers have emptied them out and marred their vine branches. Now these next verses, when I first read them, when I was first saved, I believe they referred at the time to modern conveniences. They don't. One man said he had heard them applied to trains and to cars. The shield of his mighty men is made red. The valiant men are in scarlet. One man said he had heard this preached about the followers of the Salvation Army that used to dress their upper part in scarlet or red. The valiant men are in scarlet, for the chariot shall be with flaming torches in the day of his preparation, and the fir tree shall be terribly shaken. This is when they were getting ready to defend themselves against the invaders. The chariot shall rage in the streets. They shall jostle one against another in the broadways. They shall seem like torches. They shall run like the lightning. He shall recount his worthies, that is, he'll take account of all of his warriors. This seems to be a scene within the city itself, getting ahead of the story a little bit. But notice the third chapter, Woe to the bloody city, it is full of lies and robbery, the prey departeth not. Now this is Nineveh, the noise of a whip, and the noise of the rattling of the wheels, the prancing horses, or the jumping chariots. The horseman lifteth up both the bright sword and the glittering spear. There is a multitude of slain, and a great number of carcasses, and there is none end to their carcasses, they stumble upon their carps. I read that, just getting ahead of the story. But coming back to the second chapter, he shall recount his worthies, take every step, get ready, call up all the reserves, as Syria is said to have done right lately, believing that they might be invaded by the United States. He shall recount his worthies, they shall stumble in their walk. Incidentally, a historian, a very ancient historian, says that they were so confident. You remember when Babylon was overthrown, they were having a drunken revelry. And they didn't know that very night was Belshazzar slain. And he said they were here also having a drunken revelry. And there was a legend in their city. Now, it's interesting that cities have legends. There was an old legend at Topeka, Kansas, that a tornado could never hit Topeka. I don't know if you ever heard that or not. That was supposed to have been an old Indian legend. In the 60s, they had a tornado. There were papers found right over near Leavenworth, Kansas, that were blown there from Topeka, Kansas. And somebody told me of a man finding a cake box out in the field, not too far from Leavenworth, with a cake in it that they thought came from Topeka, Kansas. Well, there was a legend that Nineveh would stand until the river became its enemy. And you know, some people believe things to such an extent that when that happens, well, that's it. Well, there was a sudden rise in the river, and it washed away a part of the wall. There was a moat about the river that they had filled with water, but the wily invaders drained that. And it is said that when they did so, the king of Nineveh got his treasures and his concubines and others in his palace and set it on fire. And incidentally, it became so totally destroyed that men wondered for a long time where it was. And it's only been in late years that it was actually found. And it was massive. Incidentally, did I call your attention to the fact that this was founded by Nimrod? Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. Maybe we better turn to the 10th chapter of the book of Genesis for just a moment. Nimrod, the mighty hunter. Many believe that he was a hunter against the Lord. But in the Genesis 10, Cush, the word Cush is the word translated Ethiopia all through the scriptures. He begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty hunter before in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel, and Erech, and Akkad, and Calneh, and the land of Shinar. Now, other versions bring out in the 11th verse, not that Asher went forth, but that he went forth to Asher. Asher was Assyria, and builded Nineveh, and the city of Rehoboth, and Calah. This was the work of Nimrod, and there isn't anything good ever said about him or his land. But back to Nahum, the second chapter, the 6th verse. The gates of the river shall be opened and the palace shall be dissolved. It was burned by the king, according to the historian. And the gates of the rivers were opened, and Huzzab, the established, shall be led away captive. In those days, war was a little bit different. And about usually when a place was captured, the people in it were taken as slaves, and they say that slavery was an advancement. At first, they killed everybody. Then after that, they found they were made pretty good work animals, so they just make slaves out of them. You remember the little maid that carried out of Israel, and many of the Jews in later years, their people redeemed them and bought them back. And you remember in the book of Joel how the Greeks had traded some for a pair of shoes. She shall be brought up, and her maid shall lead her as with the voice of doves tabering upon their breasts. But Nineveh is of old a pool of water, yet they shall flee away. Stand, stand, shall they cry, but none shall look back. The desolation was totally and complete. And when the Lord turns his hand against something, we have a few records like Sodom and Gomorrah. And I've told you how Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans. One of the most heartless cases of utter carnage in history. How that town was taken. And Jesus had said, they'll come, they'll cast a bank against you. That is, they'll build an earthen mound all the way around you, and you can't get out. And that was the way they would starve people into subjection. And so they brought the city down. You remember in the days of Elisha the prophet, when he said, behold, how this son of a murderer has come to take off my head. And they had the city under siege. Isaiah said so much, why, a donkey's head was bringing a fabulous amount of money. That's how scarce food was. And that's when Isaiah said, tomorrow about this time, my flour will be sold in Samaria for a certain amount. And the Lord said, if the Lord had opened the windows of heaven, might this thing be? And Elisha said, you'll see it, but you won't eat of it. People were so anxious to get at the food, they walked on him and killed him the next day. But that's the way a siege was. People were starved into submission. I read an article in Reader's Digest during the war past, the World War. Every ship went down out in the Pacific, I believe it was, and about 30 people got in a lifeboat that was designed for just a few, and they just, some of them eventually lived to be rescued, but they were walking skeletons. Well, this is the way people were in a siege, and in Jerusalem, the Book of Lamentations utters that awful statement. This happened in Jerusalem at that time, but it happened also in the days of Isaiah. He said, the children swoon in the streets. He said they asked their mothers for corn and wine, and they swooned as in wounded in the streets when their souls were poured out under their mother's bosom. That's in the second chapter, in the 11th and 12th verses. And then a little later, he said in the 20th verse of the second chapter, behold, O Lord, and consider to whom thou hast done this. Shall the women eat their fruit, and the children of a span long? Shall the priests and the prophets be slain in the sanctuary of the Lord? And then a little later, he said the women did eat their own children. And in the siege of Jerusalem, a woman killed her son and ate part of him, and some people tried to rob her house, and they tried, and she offered them part of this to eat. Now, this is according to Josephus, and they fled from the house in horror. Well, that was the condition things were in. You remember the two women that cried to the king, and one of them said, we ate my son yesterday, now she's hidden her son. This is in the days of Elisha, I believe. Well, a siege was an awful thing, but they were used many times. The 9th verse says, take ye the spoil of silver, take the spoil of gold, for there is none end of the store, and glory out of all the pleasant furniture. She is empty and void and waste. It's almost comical how this has lasted down to our time. In Heidelberg, Germany, we went through a castle. I had a daughter over there, and she practically paid our way over there and back. We went through a castle, and the guide spoke real fluent English. He said, the reason there isn't much furniture in the castle is that Napoleon took it when he conquered it. I couldn't help but smile at that. That sounded so much like the way people used to do. Napoleon took the furniture when he conquered the castle. I imagine it was probably highly valuable. She is empty and void and waste, and the heart melteth, and the knees smite together. You and I have never experienced probably the full horrors of war. I remember watching closely the battles in the Philippines when the Japanese came in there and starved some of our men on Corregidor into submission, and other places where people held out to the very last. And in the Southwest Pacific, where our men went into islands and the Japanese wouldn't surrender, and they blasted our caves shut where they were, and they had to leave them in there, and they stayed in there and starved. This is war. That one of the officers of the past said war is hell. And usually speaking, war is a place where no quarters are asked and none given. And notice again now that the heart melteth and the knees smite together. Much pain in all loins, and the faces of them all gather blackness, or we might render it paleness. A horrid fear gripped every heart. And we'll have confidence in our defenders. And I remember during the World War past, the British and the French had a mutual agreement pact with Poland, if I remember correctly. And on Labor Day 1939, Germany marched into Poland, and then the war started. And Belgium and those the Low Countries were with the Allies, and the Allies didn't know that they surrendered. And the French said, the French or British one, I've forgotten which now, said, the trenches that had formerly been firing at the Germans, that they suddenly started firing at us. And it was a terrible thing. And so this is what happened here. Suddenly the city couldn't be taken was taken. And if you'll think back in history, you can see the hand of God in all of this. And Adolf Hitler had a word for Europe. He called it Fortress Europe. And we had fleets of bombers called Flying Fortresses. And they didn't have to have a covering of fighters. They had enough guns to take care of themselves. And when we got into the combat in Europe, we started bombing Germany all day, and the British bombed them all night, went around the clock. And old Winston Churchill was always bandying words around. He said Hitler forgot to put a roof on his fortress. And in one case in history where a city was under siege and was holding out pretty well, the besiegers catapulted 1,000 swarms of bees into the city. Bees have a way of making you a hiding place. Then you've heard the story of the Trojan horse. And no people have permanently stayed in power too long. They will be invaded. And when the British were forced out of Dunkirk, they were left practically alone. Poland had been overrun. The French surrendered. And I had a letter from someone saying when Germany starts to invade England, they will melt. And here was the word he used, like a snowball in the July sun. But you see, there was a God in heaven. There may have been every reason to believe that the British would go down. It was reported Winston Churchill came back. Chamberlain went out, I believe it was Chamberlain. And Winston Churchill had a bulldog courage. And he made a speech. See, the British left all of their armament on Europe, in Europe, when they made their retreat. And it was called his blood and sweat and tears. He said, I have nothing to promise you but blood, sweat, and tears. And he said, we'll fight them on the beaches, we'll fight them in the streets, and went on down the line. And it was said when he sat down, he leaned over to one of his colleagues and said, I don't know what we'll fight them with unless it be beer bottles. So you see, there may have been every reason why the British should have gone down under Hitler, but they didn't. And I believe simply that God had other thoughts and other plans. There is a God in heaven. And God had said that Nineveh would go down. And notice, you can't help but think of Belshazzar. Remember that his knees smote together. And well might they. I know the Lord, and I know that I'm saved, and I know that all sins are forgiven. Tell you, it would shake me up if I'd see a hand start writing across the wall over yonder. Especially if I couldn't read it. And if I could read it, I might be more shaken. Well, this time came. And in all of these men, there are lessons to be learned. Why can't men be humble? I said to my son tonight, I think the great radio preachers are missing the boat. You know, Pentecostal people have always been liberal people. And these prominent Pentecostal men have learned that the people will give to them liberally. And instead of just hammering down on the messages that God gave them, the messages of Pentecost, they're raking in the money. Every one of them is building a large financial empire. Millions. But if God ever blesses you and ever uses you, remember one thing. Well, remember what I read. Shall the axe shake itself against him that useth it? Remember this, that all I have to do to kill every light in here is to cut off the electricity. And if I had the gift of healing and went out and had multitudes healed, all God have to do to stop me dead was just to withdraw the electricity. And just, we need to remember this. I don't care who we are. Now just take me. I never saved a man in my life. I never forgave anybody's sins before God. I can't. I never healed a man in my life. I never personally cast out a demon. If I do anything, it's in the name of Jesus, and it's because God delights in mercy. And so it's good to remember who we are. And prosperity seems to go against spirituality. It doesn't have to. It isn't what we possess. It's what possesses us that hurts. So this man became so proud. He became a great man, and Nineveh became a great city. And where is the dwelling place of the lions? Probably the leaders, and the feeding place of the young lions, where the lion, even the old lion, walked, and the lions whelped, and none made them afraid. Speaking of Nineveh, the lion did tear in pieces enough for his whelps and strangle for his lioness, filled his holes with prey and his dens with raven. They robbed every nation that they attacked. I am impressed with this. Notice this in Ezekiel just a moment. You know, you hear so much about the northern army, and people tell us exactly who it is and tell us all about it. I don't agree with a lot of them, but in the 38th chapter of Ezekiel, I'm going to read the 11th and 12th verses. And thou shalt say, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. I will go up to them that are at rest. Now this is the end time, it hasn't come yet. That dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates. Now here's the reason he will go. To take a spoil and to take a prey. I'll get rich out of the deal. To turn thine hand upon the desolate places that are now inhabited, upon the people that are gathered out of the nations which have gotten cattle and goods and dwell in the midst of the land. And that's what those things were done for. I can remember when Russia took over Latvia in the 30s. I remember when Hitler marched into Czechoslovakia and he took over Austria. And then when he marched into Poland and took over Belgium and eventually invaded Norway. And all of these countries were just taken over. And where is Hitler today? Benito Mussolini was killed and hung upside down by the feet in a filling station. As far as we know, Adolf Hitler committed suicide and evidently burned himself, if I remember the story correctly. And this has ever been the history. Why can't men read history and believe it? What happened to Belshazzar? What happened to Sodom and Gomorrah? What happened to Israel? I think of the awful fate that went to Zedekiah when he could have escaped it all. Jeremiah practically pled with him, go out and surrender yourself to the king of Babylon. He won't destroy this city. He said, I'm afraid of what, in other words, what the people will say and think. And finally, when he had to flee from the city, he had this awful experience. Nebuchadnezzar's army captured him and took his sons and killed them right before his eyes and then punched his eyes out. The last thing he could remember seeing the rest of his life was that horrid thing. And then he was taken to Babylon and died there. But people don't have to share terrible fates. They can yield to the Lord. And in the 13th verse, behold, I am against thee, saith the Lord of hosts. I will burn her chariots in the smoke, and the sword shall devour thy young lions, and I will cut off thy prey from the earth, and the voice of thy messenger shall no more be heard. They went out through the earth. Now the Lord says to this about Nineveh, woe to the bloody city. It is all full of lies and robbery, and the prey departeth not. The vaunting that people do when they've cheated somebody. It is not, saith the buyer, but or when it is a seller, I forgot which one is used in Proverbs, but when he goeth, he boasteth. I really put across a deal with him. I cheated him out of everything he had. But notice what this is all about, robbery. They'd go out and conquer a nation, and then they would use them to pay tribute, as they had had Hezekiah doing. But then if they wouldn't pay tribute, then they'd come down and whip them, take over the country. Now he speaks. And imagine yourself being in the midst of this. The noise of a whip, the noise of the rattling of the wheels of the prancing horses, and of the jumping chariots. The horseman lifteth up both the bright sword and the glittering spear, and there is a multitude of slain, killed everywhere. Nobody, there was no sparing. And you may think now that our men are different. I don't know whether you know Sanford Peck or not. I'm sure Brother Sister Agers know him. He got into Germany, into Europe late, and he said, they were bringing out truckloads of German prisoners standing up just as long as one could stand on a truck. And he said they were just the trucks. We were going in on trucks, and they would just come just this close to each other. And he said our men would take their rifle butts and start pounding those prisoners just as hard as they could. Now, if you'll think about it like this, they were thinking like this, it weren't for you dirty so-and-sos, we wouldn't be over here. You're the cause of it, and we'll take it out on you. But then there was no mercy in it, was there? Those men had surrendered, and in late years, we have learned we're just like everybody else, actually perpetrating killings abroad, assassinations. And I'm glad I'm an American. I've seen enough of the world to know that I can say, thank God, I'm an American. I'd rather live here than anywhere else in the world. But we're all cut off the same bolt of cloth. And I'm going to read Jeremiah 47:3 in connection with this scene that is drawn here. The prophet talks as if he were looking at it. He didn't see it, actually. The third verse says, at the noise of the stamping of the hoofs of his strong horses, at the rushing of his chariots, at the rumbling of his wheels. Then it goes on to say, the fathers shall not look back to their children for feebleness of hand, because the day that cometh to spoil the Philistines. But notice how similar it was. And you can imagine the horses. Now, horses in those days were trained to fight. Literally, they were. I'm amazed that people can train nearly any animal. Now, you don't think of an animal, of an ox. Over here, we think of a dog or a horse as being trained to do tricks. But I've seen oxen that would obey commands in the way of tricks. In other parts of the world, never saw one in America. The fellow said he didn't have him too well trained, that he was young. But he could tell him to do things, and he would do them. Well, the horses of yore were trained to fight. And they had, some nations had knives in the wheels of their chariots, set at an angle, and they turned. And if they got close to you, naturally, it was just the same as being hit with a sword. And notice it again, the horseman lifteth up both the bright sword and the glittering spear. There is a multitude of slain and a great number of carcasses. There is none into their corpses. They stumble upon their corpses as though they were just like mar in the streets. And then he tells it's because of their unchastities and their witchcrafts that they had sold to all nations through her whoredoms and families through her witchcrafts. And again, I am against thee, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will discover thy skirts upon thy face. Now, use a figure of speech here that would be the very highest indignity of stripping a woman's skirt clear up to her face. But I will show the nations thy nakedness, and the kingdoms thy shame. Now, this is not said about individual women. It's said about Babylon, and God wanted the nations to see what he had done for her, that they might remember. But do the nations remember? Has America remembered? We haven't, and we won't. I knew a young man, he's in his 20s, that graduated from college in Tahlequah, Oklahoma, in Tulsa, and he said to me, things are so much worse than they were when I was in college. And that was less than 10 years. And now they say, I think 25% of all high school students, at least, use some form of dope. And we have over 9 million alcoholics. We've changed the words. We used to call them drunkards. But we don't remember. Sin is a reproach to any people, we read back. Righteousness exalteth a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people, we read in the book of Proverbs. I will cast abominable filth upon thee and make thee vile, and will set thee as a gazing stock. Let us turn for just a moment to the book of Jude. Speaking of examples and remembering and seeing things as God sees them, Jude makes a very striking statement in this book. The 7th verse, even as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities about them in like manner, giving themselves over to fornication and going after strange flesh, are set forth for an example. That's an interesting statement, isn't it? We're living in a time when more and more people are like Edgar Allan Poe, who couldn't see sin in any form of practice. He couldn't see sin. We have a young man that works in our meeting, brother, or comes to our meeting, Brother Sleevy, and he was up here the other day, and he said there's a man that works where he does, said he's very wealthy, and he doesn't work because he has to, he just works because he wants to work. And he said, well, Mr. Sleevy, you don't drink, and you don't do this, and you don't do that. What do you live for? He said, I live for the Lord Jesus Christ. And he said, the fellow changed the subject right quick. Suffering as set forth for an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. And yet, we're living in a day. Now, I called your attention to what the spirit of Sodom and Gomorrah was, and I don't like to touch on it, but I will. They didn't want Lot's daughters. They wanted those two men. There, incidentally, there was an election today. One of the states may have elected an accused homo, a man who was, and why, those things don't enter into things at all in people's concept anymore. If he can get the job done, let him do it. Now, this is what one of our generals said at one time, and I don't like to quote it. His words are nasty. Give the men women to hell with the morals. Take care of the morale. What are they fighting for? Who's the worst? The man they're shooting or the man that's doing the shooting? What am I fighting for? If I'm that kind of a person, I'd just be just as well for me to be dead as for him to be dead. So this is God wanted the nations to see Nineveh. Said he would hold them up, so to speak. Notice that word again. I will show the nations thy nakedness and the kingdoms thy shame. I'll let them see why I overthrew you. And it is interesting that Babylon followed the same route. And this is interesting to me. I was thinking about it this past week. Belshazzar was in a drunken feast when Babylon was overthrown by the Medes and the Persians. And some years later, Alexander the Great overthrew that part of the world again. And then, morally speaking, it overthrew him. He went to a party and drank an enormous amount of wine. But he was invited to another party after this one was over. And it proved to them that this one meant just as much as that one did, so he tried to drink just as much over there as he did over here. It killed him. That's interesting, isn't it? These two great cities, and then that man who was an extremely, from the viewpoint of being a general, he was a general. Of course, he was just a heathen. He killed his own best friend and then moaned about it. But anyway, that he should die of drunkenness and revelry. I told you about the wine cask that I saw in Germany. I had a pamphlet, have a pamphlet on it somewhere. It was so big, it was took 186 oak trees to make it. It wasn't a little one. It was a massive affair. And this king, so it said, had wine piped to every room. And it looks so much that way in America, where you can buy it anywhere, and people do. We have at our town the oldest distillery west of the Mississippi River. We have a winery. We grow lots of tobacco and lots of marijuana. I have everything but a gambling casino. And who knows? It shall come to pass that all they that look upon thee shall flee from thee and say, Nineveh is laid waste. Who will bemoan her? Whence shall I seek comforters for thee? She had probably made herself so hated that all the nations around were glad when she fell, just like the world was glad when Adolf Hitler went down. Art thou better than populace know? This was a city up in southern Egypt, way up the Nile, and it had water around it as a moat, and yet it was overthrown. It was situated among the rivers. It was right on the Nile. Had the waters round about it, and whose rampart was the sea, and her wall was from the sea. Well, we'll have to stop here for a few moments, and we'll come back. More than populous, no. This is a great city, as I mentioned, in southern Egypt. And she had lots of defense. Ethiopia and Egypt were her strength, and it was infinite. Put, this is believed to have been Punt. I can't find much on it. And the Lubims, believed to be Libya, were thy helpers. They had lots of helpers. But when it comes time for God to overthrow a place, it's like he said to Israel, if the Babylonian army was all wounded men, they would yet overthrow this city. Yet was she carried away, that is, populous No, or Noamon. She went into captivity. Her young children also were dashed in pieces at the top of the streets, and they cast lots for her honorable men, and all her great men were bound in chains. Now this describes the heartlessness of a siege, and especially of the heathen world. Children meant nothing. Different places in the scripture it speaks of expectant mothers being ripped up or ripped open when cities were taken. And at times there was absolutely no mercy shown to anyone. And you know, I mentioned the British bombing, making their nightly raids, and we made the day raids in the war. I also mentioned in an earlier lesson that they used at times 4-ton bombs. Seemed to me like that would just totally paralyze you if you were off quite a little distance from it when it went off. And they used far bombs, and they experimented with bats with incendiaries attached to them that would fly into any building they came to. Well, that's war. Thou also shalt be drunken, thou shalt be hid, thou also shalt seek strength because of the enemy. All thy strongholds shall be like fig trees with the first ripe figs. If they be shaken, they shall even fall into the mouth of the eater. Several times in different places in the scripture says their defenders would be like women. That is, I suppose a woman wouldn't be too skilled with a sword or with a spear. And their strongholds, let's say their fortresses, would be as easily taken as the first ripe figs would be taken when you could shake the fig tree and they'd fall into the mouth of the eater. Behold, the people in the midst of thee are women. The gates of thy land shall be set wide open unto thine enemies, and the fire shall devour thy bars. All of this came to pass. It adds up to one thing, that whatever phase in life a man is in, he had better be on the side of the Lord. Somebody said, if someone asked Lincoln, do you think the Lord is with us? He said, that isn't the important thing. What is important is that we be with the Lord. We be on his side. Make that a special point. A word of advice, draw thee waters for the siege. Fortify thy strongholds. Go into the clay, tread out the mortar. Make strong the brick kiln. That is, have brick ready to mend the walls when they're breached, or to build a new wall inside of the breach. They did this too. And sometimes they had a wall inside of a wall. So if one was breached, another one would be there to defend. And it is said that in excavating Jericho, they found that there were double walls, and when they fell, it looked like there had been an explosion. One wall went that way and one went the other. And I guess you might call the power of God an explosion, but in that instance, it wasn't just a freak of nature that did it, like the river coming up suddenly and dissolving some of the walls of Nineveh, or like the besiegers turned the river into dry lake beds, so they tell us, when Babylon was invaded and they marched right in through the gates. It wasn't something on this order. That was a miraculous caving in of the walls, though some stupid minister of Satan said that the 7 days they were marching around the walls, the foundations of the city were made out of wood, and they had set them on fire, and they were waiting for the foundations to burn out. There shall the fire devour thee. The sword shall cut thee off. It shall eat thee up like the cankerworm. Make thyself many as the cankerworm. Make thyself many as the locusts. Let them be as many as they would, God had decided to destroy them. Thou hast multiplied thy merchants above the stars of heaven. The cankerworm spoileth and fleeth away. Thy crowned, that is, your leaders, are as the locust, and thy captains as the grasshopper, which camp in the hedges in the cold day. Now, as you know, cold weather will disable a grasshopper. And he said, your leaders are like this, but he said, when they can do something, he said, they flee away. They don't stay and fight. Thy shepherd slumber, O king of Assyria. Thy nobles shall dwell in the dust. Thy people is scattered upon the mountains, and no man gathereth them. The overthrow of a proud people is a pretty terrible thing. When people that have been up high suddenly have to come down low. Every once in a while you'll read of somebody that's been brought down very low. I mentioned the other night about reading of a governor, a lieutenant governor, that became an alcoholic and was a taxi cab driver. That's quite a come down, isn't it? And of a world champion. Now, sometimes these championships fights involve $1 or $2 million or more. Well, one of the world champion pugilists was selling neckties to try to make a living. But to see a whole people brought down, like, for example, the Jews, sold into slavery till nobody would buy them, then forced to go around the Mediterranean, east side of the Mediterranean, to Rome to march in a triumph there, and being killed along the way if they couldn't keep up. To see all this come upon them, what a thing it was. There is no healing of thy bruise. In other words, things get so bad at times that there is no remedy. And this is the way it was in the days of Sodom and Gomorrah. And this is the way it was in the days of Nebuchadnezzar when he overthrew Judea. This is the way it was in the days of the Romans when they overthrew Jerusalem. Titus did not want the temple burned, but it burned. It has been said that the fire melted the gold, and the gold ran in among the rocks, and the soldiers pried the rocks up to get the gold. And that way it was destroyed right down to the foundation. Of course, some of the foundation stones were left. That's where the Wailing Wall was for so many years. No healing of thy bruise, thy wound is grievous. All that hear the bruit, that's the old English word for report of thee, shall clap the hands over thee. Like you remember children, you say, goody, goody, goody. They were glad when Nineveh went down. For upon whom hath not thy wickedness passed continually? They were domineering. A conquering people can be very domineering. I read an article one time. France had been overcome in war, and I've forgotten the circumstances who overcame them, but there was a fellow, a French soldier, snapped down at a table like this, just not much more than his head sticking out. And a fellow came along and just kept taunting him and making fun of him. Finally, he straightened up and got up, and he was actually the biggest man in the French army. And he said he grabbed that fellow this way, jerked his mouth open and spit down his throat and turned around and walked out. Broke his jaw in the process. Well, overlords can be so heartless. True or false, I don't know. This was reported in a magazine about Benito Mussolini. When he was in his heyday, he was going down the street and there was a newspaper. This newspaper reporter was supposedly with him, and he ran over a child, not intentionally, but he did run over it. He didn't even stop, and this fellow said something to him about it, and he said, never look back. He just kept going. Well, to me, I think if I'd run over a child, I'd have nightmares the rest of my life. But anyway, all the nations would clap their hands. Upon whom hath not thy wickedness passed continually? Just a continual brutality. A killing meant nothing to them. Life was so cheap. Hudson Taylor, when he went to went as a missionary to China, was going up river, and a man went overboard. A man fell overboard, and they didn't even slow down. Didn't even try to rescue him, and he offered the money to try to get them to rescue him. Well, by the time they got around to it, the man was already drowned. But how little life is thought of in much of the world.